Welcome to the official podcast of the Irish Association of Speech and Language Therapists, the IASLT in Conversation. Recently, Virgin Media Television broadcast a series called Brain Doctors Inside Neurosurgery. So today, we are talking with Padraig Ryan, who is a senior SLT working in the National Centre for Neurosurgery in Beaumont Hospital, Dublin. Thank you so much for taking the time to speak to us today, Padraig.
No problem. Thanks for having me on.
Maybe we might start with how you came to be an SLT in the area of neurosurgery.
So I'm one of the graduates of the MSc in Speech and Language Therapy from the University of Limerick. So I graduated from there in 2021 and started in Beaumont as a staff grade. Did my rotations through Beaumont here, and I've just recently started as the senior therapist here in neurosurgery in May. So I'm a relatively new senior in the area, but loving it all the same.
So what motivated you to work in an adult acute setting?
So I completed one of my placements during college in the Mater Hospital, and I really just fell in love with working with adults when I was there. I got experience working on neurology and spinal wards, and it was, I just really loved it. I kind of went into the speech and language therapy course, but probably like a lot of others, not knowing the full scope of what we could do, and thought that I would end up working in peds. Had some past experience in youth work, loved working with teenagers, but I suppose I found out I didn't really have the energy levels to keep up with kids and peds, and just really loved working with adults, and got my first job then as a graduate SLT here in Beaumont, and have just kind of worked my way through different rotations to the role that I'm in now.
Fantastic. And what were kind of the other rotations like? So you're a neurosurgery at the moment, but what kind of have you done?
So as a staff grade, so that's one of the real benefits, I suppose, of working in an acute hospital setting, is there's exposure to so many different areas. So I started out, I was working in care of the older persons on the acute wards. I was working with patients with dementia, Parkinson's, I suppose frailty, and spent a couple of months doing that. And then we have what we call our gen med rotation, so spent some time on just the general admission wards. Really anything could come in the door, you're not really quite sure why somebody's going to get referred. It's a real mixture of everything. You get outliers from different areas of ENT and neurology and some stroke cases, so that's a real mixed bag of experience. And I suppose then I had the opportunity to do my rotation in neurosurgery. Just as a result of some staffing changes here, an opportunity came to do a rotation that was a year long, which would be unusual. Okay. So usually the rotations are maybe 6 months long here. So I spent a year in neurosurgery here and developed a love for it. That was only in my second year as a staff grade. So I did look to do another rotation after that. So I spent some time in rehabilitation in St. Joseph's Hospital in Raheny. Again, it's a care of the older persons rehabilitation, so over 65s. So working with people after stroke, Parkinson's, doing LSVT with people. And then the opportunity for a senior position in neurosurgery was available. I applied and was successful in that and started in May of this year.
Fantastic. It sounds like you've got a huge kind of wealth of experience working in the hospital.
For sure. And it's one of the real benefits of working in a hospital. It's it can be hectic and busy, and like I said, you don't know what's going to walk through the door, but there's the wealth of exposure you get to different conditions and presentations, and the wealth of knowledge and experience that's here is great. I really value that, having worked in Beaumont here for the last 3 years.
I imagine it's quite daunting too, just coming out of college and then going into into that, where it seems like there's so much going on, like even the general medco that you were saying, like that's quite daunting. Yeah,
for sure. And I can imagine, like, I was lucky in that I had an acute placement, and I feel like obviously your placements really shape your experience going forward. And I suppose I can imagine if I hadn't had that acute placement, it probably wouldn't have seemed like a place that I would have wanted to work. You know, I don't think before my placement I'd ever set foot inside a hospital other than a broken arm. But it was, you know, it was it's a chaotic place, and unless you kind of get that exposure to it, I don't know if anybody would usually seek out to work in it.
Yeah, that's a really good point, actually. Yeah. And kind of placements can be kind of difficult to get at the moment. So, you know, even the quality of them and thinking about different areas and making sure that therapists get that exposure to different areas is really important.
For sure. And like what I would say, like we've had definitely people come in to do maybe a day's shadowing at different points. And like, I think that would, like, if I was to encourage people that they're not sure what area they want to work in, seek out maybe a local therapist in a hospital near you, just to get an idea of what their day is like and what they get up to. Because it is wildly different to what other people do. I know you work in peds, and I suppose I have friends that I've studied with, and we meet up sometimes, and it's crazy to me that we studied in the same course. We're talking about like our day, and it's, you know, I've gone to see a brain surgery, and they've been out on a home visit and having a tea party. It's funny, you know, it's funny.
Yeah. It's strange to think that we have the same degree, but it's so different. The work is so different.
Sure.
But that, I think that's really good advice, you know, the shadowing and things like that, to try and figure out what areas you're interested in. That's a really good idea. So I suppose, what does a typical day look like for you at the moment?
I suppose it's quite varied. I suppose we come in the morning, we look at our new referrals, and just prioritizing who's there to be seen for the day. So in the neurosurgical caseload, I get a really good mixture of communication referrals and dysphagia referrals, which I really like. I think in some of the other rotations that I mentioned I'd done, it's very dysphagia heavy, and a lot of swallow assessments and swallow reviews and changing recommendations. And I think it's real 50-50 with this caseload. So I suppose, yeah, I might spend a morning taking some new admissions. We get admissions from all around the country in neurosurgery. And typically I see patients post their surgeries. If I'm lucky, I might get to meet them pre and post, but I suppose we don't always have the capacity to provide that service. So I meet patients usually after their surgeries, and really just kind of meeting them where they're at. I kind of describe sometimes I might feel like I'm just having a conversation with the patient, or just really trying to put them at ease, but I suppose I'm assessing them all the time and what they're saying, and trying to pick up on maybe what is difficult for them and where I might go next with my assessment, and what kind of assessment that I might pull out to dig a little deeper into how they're presenting. So, that's the communication side of things. Dysphagia, I suppose, referrals always take priority. We get lots of patients who might be nail by mouth until I come to see them after their surgery. A morning might be a lot of swallow assessments, maybe the afternoon some communication assessments. Lots of tracheostomy work as well. So patients who have come maybe from ICU, and I'd be involved in their tracheostomy weaning with my physiotherapy colleagues. That could be mixed into the day. There's also extra clinics and video fluoroscopy, and lots of different meetings about the house for different projects that are happening on the neurosurgical ward. So it can be a really mixed and varied day in neurosurgery. Yeah.
Fantastic. And am I right in saying that you do kind of awake craniotomy surgeries?
So that's another big part of the role here, and something that I managed to do my my training in as a staff grade. And it's, yeah, a really interesting part of the job. And again, something that I never thought I'd be doing, I suppose, at this stage of my career. Like I said, I'm only 3 years really over the line of being a speech and language therapist. But yeah, the opportunity presented itself through some staffing changes that were happening here. And we needed some extra bodies that were trained. And yeah, I completed my training in November of last year and have, as the senior in neurosurgery, I suppose it's my area of responsibility now to participate in the awake craniotomies.
And what was kind of the training like? What kind of things do you do? Because as you said, I'm in a completely different area. I think it's a fascinating area.
Yeah, so it was just as an explainer. So I suppose an awake craniotomy is a bit like what it says on the tin. It's an awake brain surgery, and it is undertaken by the surgeons when there is a concern around speech or language function as a result of the surgery. So they describe it as appropriate for eloquent brain areas. It's a bit vague in what that means, but I suppose particular areas where they know it's a danger zone for speech or language function. Mm-hmm. So they may they ask speech and language to complete pre-operative assessment and intra-op and post-op assessment of language function to, I suppose, maintain as much function as they possibly can for the best outcome in the surgery. So yeah, the training is an in-house procedure. So I suppose there was a lot of work done in this area by a previous speech and language therapist that worked here. I've really only just picked up the reins. There was a lot of the protocols that we have in place here were set in place by Joy that used to work here and Arlene after her. So there is a training procedure of attending, you observe to, kind of do half of the surgery part of two of them, and then you fully attend the last two surgeries. I suppose. Yeah, it's a tricky one to try and imagine if you haven't been in the hot seat, but it's an unusual place to find yourself as a speech and language therapist, I would say.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So during the craniotomy, you're kind of assessing language before, during, and after, is that right?
Yeah. I'll talk you through the procedure. I suppose we would always meet the patients before the surgery for a preoperative assessment. So we have a battery of assessments that we would do, and I suppose we want to see if there is any. So the patient is presenting with a brain tumor of some description, usually in the left frontal or temporal areas, where there is, I suppose, language involved or implicated. And we want to see if they're presenting with any preoperative language difficulties. So we bring them in, we do a large battery of assessments. There, we do like an object and action naming battery. So it's a variety of pictures. We do some semantic testing using the pyramids and palm trees assessment. We do some motor speech tasks, repetition. We do some basic auditory comprehension tasks. And then I do an interview of sorts where I just find out loads of information about the patient. There's conversation topics that I can talk to the patient about during the surgery. So things that are really familiar to them, I would just ask them, what is a bit like this interview, what does a typical day look like for you? Talk me through a day in work. Tell me about the last holiday you went on. What's your favorite movie? Talk me through the plot. Talk me through how to make your favorite recipe. Loads of things. I have lots of prompts for myself. Some people can be very, very chatty, and some people can be not very, very chatty at all. It's really just trying to get something that I'll be able to talk to them about. Often I have to talk to them, repeat the topics over and over again during the surgery. So that's all preoperative. Then the day of the surgery, I come and meet the patient up on the ward, just trying to put them at ease. I suppose we're going to be face to face with each other for a couple of hours, so I just really want them to be comfortable with me and to feel like they're able to talk to me, because I will be talking to them for going forward. And I kind of prepare my materials then for the surgery. One of the things I have to do the morning of is I mentioned the pictures that I pre-assessed somebody on. If they've made any mistakes or if there's any ambiguity around what they may have named the pictures, I just take those ones out, because I don't want to incorrectly identify any errors during the surgery then. So if there's one of the pictures is it's to be named as a picture frame. Sometimes people call it a stamp. It kind of looks like a stamp. I take it out. I don't want to call that an error when it isn't during the surgery. So I just kind of spend the morning preparing my materials, writing out notes for myself on our conversation topics. And then at some point in the morning, I'll get a phone call and I'll head down to the surgical theater. There's different methods of doing the surgery. I'm not an anesthesiologist. I don't know the ins and outs of why they decide to do certain things, but there is what we call controlled conscious sedation. So sometimes the patient is maybe just under light sedation until I come down and they're able to then make them more alert for me to engage with. There is an asleep awake asleep method. So the patient will start off completely under anesthesia, intubated. And then when the surgeon has gotten to the appropriate area of the brain, they'll decide to wake them up and extubate them. And then I'll jump in and have a chat with them. When I come down, we do what's called language mapping. So that is myself, the neurophysiologist, and the neurosurgeon. The neurosurgeon will apply kind of small amounts of electrical stimulation to the exposed tumor while I'm showing pictures. So the patient is naming the pictures, and I'm trying to identify any changes in their speech or any difficulty in naming or a delay in naming or maybe just a complete speech arrest, to try and find where the language is implicated in the tumor. So I just shout error, and then the surgeon is able to mark that area of the tumor as a danger zone, for want of a better word. I'm just very quickly flying through the pictures, looking for any change at all. If I might show somebody a picture of a fork and they might say spoon, that's a semantic error, flag that area. If they have a delay of longer than 4 seconds, that's an error, and again flag that to the surgeon. Sometimes the neurophysiologists are involved. They are able to up the amps of stimulation to make sure we're really catching true errors. They might look to make sure to see that an error is reproducible. So if I flagged an error, they might go back and test that area again, and they can say that there's a reproducible error in this area. That's a danger zone. And then I suppose, once they've mapped out the space where it's safe to resect, they start their resection of the surgery, and I continue to assess for as long as they need me. So I'll be flying through pictures, I'll be doing conversation tasks, repetition tasks, motor speech tasks, it can go on for quite a while. And again, any changes at all that I notice, I just communicate them to the surgeon. that's my role, is looking for any changes and communicating them over. I'm not cutting, I'm not doing anything, I'm just flagging any concerns that I see.
Very good. And how long does it usually take then? How long, or is it different for every surgery?
It's been really different. There was once it was 45 minutes from going down, mapping, assessment, and they were happy with the progress, to I think the longest time I spent was 5 hours, which is, it's a long time, because you're hunched over, you're kind of, there's drapes all around the patient, you're leaning in, you're trying to manage your pictures. It's not exactly a safe space for a toilet break. So it's you have to really manage yourself quite well. You know, you have to make sure I eat a good breakfast that morning, because you really don't know how long you're going to be down there for. It's an amazing environment. The teams work so well down there. The communication that happens between like the nurses and the anesthesiologist, and you know, myself, the first few times I went down, I probably looked a bit Bambi-eyed, not knowing where to be. But you know, everyone, they know that it's not a natural place for us to be, or we're hugely exposed to. So you do feel put at ease down there, and they value our input and our role down there. They're reliant on my expertise in that area too. It's a real team role down there, I would say.
Fantastic. And then post-op, do you do the same kind of assessments that you did pre-op?
I suppose typically what I say to patients is the 3 to 5 days post-op is potentially not going to be great for them. And one of the lines I sometimes say, and it helps the patients to not be really worried in the first couple of days, is that the surgery is to benefit them. It's, you know, they're taking out a tumor that is they don't want to be there. But regardless of that, their brain is going through a trauma. So their brain is, they're in there, they're poking around, they're cutting, there's swelling that's going to happen afterwards, there's bleeding, that it's, and the brain has to recover in the first couple of days. So I would expect that there may be some difficulties in the first couple of days, which I don't panic about, and I try to ask the patient not to panic themselves about either. There may be some mild word finding difficulties, some fatigue is going to be a big impact in the first couple of days after surgery. But our protocol is that the day one post-op, I do at least an informal language screen. And from that, maybe two or three days later, I might pick other areas that I want to probe a little bit more into. Some people are absolutely fine day one post-op. I can discharge them the day one post-op. They can be flagged to me if anything comes up. But I suppose that's the goal as well. I suppose the reason we're doing it as WAKE is to avoid any major deficits post-op. But I repeat a lot of the pre-op assessments in the post-op days. I mightn't do the full battery on day one, but I will definitely at least do an informal screen.
Okay, so over the next kind of 5 days or so, not all together.
Yeah, okay. It can just be a lot in those first couple of days, and rest is really important as well. Like I said, kind of you want any that spontaneous recovery to happen, but you definitely want to see if there's a major deficit, and especially if there are errors that I've noticed during the surgery. So when I'm continuing to assess, if I've noticed that they're starting to make some semantic errors in conversation, or they were really having difficulty with initiation towards the end of the surgery, that might make it more of a concern to me in the post-op assessment. So I'm kind of keeping an eye out for those things.
Very good. And how often do you do kind of craniotomies? Are they
I think our numbers were last year, again, I'm only trained in this since last November. So I think the numbers for last year were there was maybe 15 or 16 across the year. So it's not super frequent. There's only certain surgeons that do them here as well. Like there are craniotomies happening every day in the hospital here, but I suppose the awake ones are less frequent. But I suppose for one therapist, I mean, 15 in a year is quite a number. So it's definitely kept busy with them.
So are you the only one doing them at the moment?
So as the senior neurosurgery, I'm doing them now, but there are two other therapists who are trained from other services. So if I on leave or unavailable for whatever reason, there are other people who can cover the service, and we're going to train somebody else this year as well. There can always be availability for them.
Very good. And just how many people are in the department? So in the neurosurgery department, are there a few SLTs? Are you the kind of
myself as the senior, and there's one staff grade who will be doing her neurosurgery rotation. So she will rotate in October. Just having started, it's my first opportunity to supervise somebody as well, which has been a great experience. It's just two people. There's a little bit, so we one of the therapists who works on the neurology ward and does get some neurosurgical cases on there too. Staffing wise, there's one senior and some staffing for a staff grade as well.
And then the rotation of staff grade. And they change every 6 months?
Every 6 months, yeah. Sometimes it can be a little bit longer, shorter. Yeah, there's not an exact science to the rotations here, but and it's really exciting, rotation to do. Like I spoke about all the experience that I got from it. So, like as a staff grade, you're always like, oh, I can't wait to do my neurosurgery rotation, because you know you get your tracheostomy training, you get loads of exposure to so many different presentations. So we get lots of training, which is great.
And speaking of the kind of training, you mentioned tracheostomy training, and obviously you got the training in the awake craniotomy. Is there any other kind of trainings that have helped you?
Yeah, I suppose another area that comes up a lot in the neurosurgery case is what we call PDOC, so it would be prolonged disorders of consciousness. So maybe people who have experienced a brain injury, or maybe haven't recovered neurologically very well after a surgery for a bleed or a brain tumor, who would be presenting with really low levels of alertness and awareness. They mightn't be responding to stimuli in their environment, or they might suddenly scratch their nose, but they mightn't be show any awareness to sounds or light, or but they're it's a difficult one to describe. They're not in a coma, but they're not alert and aware and interacting with people. So we jointly with occupational therapists have assessments that we do where we kind of map people's alertness and awareness. So, you know, are they able to respond to a sudden clap that beside their ear? Do their eyes flinch, or do they turn their head to seek out the sound? If I ask them a question, are they vocalizing to try and respond, or are they not responding at all? If I bring a spoon to their lips, are they showing me that they're aware of something? If I put a trickle of water but at the corner of their lips, do they seek it out with their tongue or do they try to wipe it away with their hand? So it's a very stringent kind of assessment that we do, and it informs rehab consultants from the National Rehab Hospital around what maybe beds that they might need. So they're really always really interested in how somebody's progressing in terms of their alertness and awareness. And we can certain if somebody is showing some recovery, we can do what we call emergence tests. So to say that somebody has emerged from a disorder of consciousness. So, you know, is a person able to functionally use objects? They may not be able to respond yes or no, or they may not be able to discriminate between objects. But if I put a cup in their hand, will they bring it up to their mouth? If I put a comb in their hand, do they know, recognize it and just say, oh, this is for brushing my hair? Yeah, we're just this week, we had a man who has emerged from a disorder of consciousness. He doesn't have any verbal output. He's nil by mouth, but I suppose he's able to, if you put a pen in his hand and start a game of X's and O's, he'll start putting some X's in the boxes, showing us that he has some awareness of what he's doing. He's functionally using the marker to draw. And yeah, it was a really, really positive one this week for somebody who hasn't been able to do a lot for such a long time. So it's kind of giving us new areas to try and work on with him.
Fantastic. That sounds like a really interesting kind of training. And
So this was a staff group that I have at the minute. She's getting to exposure to these, and she's learning about this area. And in terms of other CPD, like videofluoroscopies are an in-house training that we're able to do here. Fees is probably the next training that'll be approached about at some point. The more training you add in, the more areas you get pulled into. So it's trying to balance out your capacity.
100%. It sounds like, you know, for such a small team, I guess, of SLTs, there's a kind of a broad area for you. All the training is good, but as you said, it also makes you get pulled into other areas.
Yeah, but I suppose I really like that. I suppose there's some days here where you think, that was a mad morning. You know, I could do a pre-op for an awake craniotomy, then go see a tracheostomy, then a swallow. It's such a varied morning, which I love. I really like that part of this role.
Fantastic. And in some previous podcasts, we've kind of discussed advocating the role of SLT in various kind of teams and areas. Are there challenges in advocating for SLT in the neurosurgical team?
There are and there aren't. I suppose having done other rotations, I definitely have noticed how, like, even among the nursing staff, the MDT and the medical team, there's definitely a better understanding of SLT in this neurosurgical area. The referrals that I get are really appropriate. You know, sometimes somebody's admitting difficulty is an expressive aphasia. You know, I get a referral immediately for that. The surgeons are obviously busy in their surgeries, but they absolutely will approach you to discuss a patient, and they're certainly approachable if you have a question. I know I've approached some of the consultant surgeons to ask questions around what they think the recovery is going to look like. And for sure, you know, working more closely with them in the awake surgeries, they have a really good understanding of our role and how we can support in that area. And you know, among the MDT, we work really closely as an MDT, and in that regard, I don't feel like there's much advocating to do. We all really have a good grip of everybody's role in the team. Definitely advocating as the medical teams rotate and there's new batches of regs and SHOs and interns that who may have come from another team where there wasn't a huge role for SLT, or there wasn't a huge SLT presence. So it can be a really good opportunity to educate them and know, if I'm requesting a video fluoroscopy order, like why I want that and the benefit for this patient of them supporting that. So definitely there's always advocating to do. There's always educating to do on the wards. But I feel it's less of a challenge in this area than other clinical areas that I've like experience in.
Yeah, it sounds like their knowledge of what SLTs do and the importance is there. You know, it's entrenched really in the department.
It's good, yeah.
Which is great. Are there any other kind of positives or challenges about your role?
Yeah, challenges, I suppose, are... I love that I jumped straight to challenges. I feel like we all do that. I suppose it's there's a huge volume of referrals and patients. I suppose it's the National Center for Neurosurgery here, so we get patients from all around the country. So there's be patients transferring in from Galway and Letterkenny, Mayo, Sligo, all the hospitals around the country. And I suppose there's a huge amount of administration involved in that. So when I get a referral and a patient transfers back to their admitting hospital, then I have, you know, any assessments that I've done, handovers to do back to the SLTs in the local hospital. So a good chunk of my morning, I could come in on a Wednesday morning, for three or four of my patients could be gone, transfer back to their hospital. So I have to spend the morning finding out that they have gone to the hospital and not suddenly been discharged home, emailing handovers, phone calling different departments. I'm constantly on to different SLTs around the country with handovers. And I suppose the other side of it is then for the patients who do maybe have ongoing difficulties and are transferring or are discharging home. And I suppose the lack of community services that are available at times. I know that I've had some really tough conversations with patients who, you know, are continuing to present with communication difficulties. I'm advising them that I'm going to send a referral to community, but their wait time could be months before they're seen, and trying to get them set up with some independent exercises that they can continue at home. It can be tricky. And I suppose the other side then is the wait times for rehab services. You know, we have the National Rehab Hospital, but there's such long wait times, and patients can be waiting here for months to go. And that's tricky then, trying to manage an acute service when there are long-term patients who need rehab here, and that can be really challenging to try and balance into your day. But you just give people as much as you're able. We do have a speech therapy assistants here who we try to set patients up with programs as much as they're able, but it can be a challenging one to balance that patients transferring out, new patients coming in, and the long-term patients that are here. That those would be the challenges, I would say. And positive, yeah. Now you did ask me positive as well. I think I mentioned before the MDT are incredible, and we have nurse specialists here who are incredible at working with the patients, and we really do have a team approach to everybody, you know, and we all understand the value in each other's roles, and we are very good at advocating for patients if we don't feel like they're ready to go home. You know, that the team sometimes do listen to us, and we can, you know, if we need time getting you know, home care set up or different things, or you know, we work really well as a team, I would say. Yeah, that's definitely the big positive, I would say, in neurosurge.
Fantastic. And you mentioned that you're kind of a new senior.
Yes.
Is there any advice that you would give to anybody starting out as a senior therapist?
I would say I'm very open in saying that I absolutely don't know everything in this area. I'm such a new person to this area. And I definitely said that in my first supervision with my staff grade, is that I don't know everything, and I definitely will have to ask questions to the other seniors at times if there's something I can't answer. So I think being aware of that there's still, you know, you might be a senior in an area, but there's still so much to learn, and there's so much growing to do. Like, I'm just at the cutoff to be eligible to be a senior, so I think coming in too big for my boots in this, you know, clinical area, I don't think would be a benefit to anybody. I still want to learn. I still want to, there's probably different cases and presentations I still haven't been exposed to. There's still so much research and reading for me to do. You know, even I know I spoke about the awake craniotomies, but I'm still new to that as well, I feel, and still getting comfortable in that role. And, you know, looking at the process we have, is there things that I might like to change? I'm not going to come in and start changing everything immediately, but, you know, looking at, I think looking at the skills you have and where there is to grow is a good way to approach things as a new senior, I feel.
Fantastic. Great. Being a male SLT in kind of a profession where it's more female dominated, have you any kind of advice for men out there thinking of becoming SLTs, student SLTs? We've had a couple of podcasts on this, but I think it is important to mention because you probably work with a lot of female colleagues.
Yes, I do. I'm the only man in the department here. Yeah.
So, have you any advice, for men starting out or thinking of going into SLT or maybe in college?
I suppose it's never something that's hugely bothered me. My undergrad was in psychology, which was kind of a female dominated area as well. I kind of knew coming into this that I would be in the minority. There was one other guy in my course in college. Advice. I think, you know, at the end of the day, there's nothing hugely female oriented about the job that we do, and I think it's unusual to me why it has become such a female dominated profession. I think we're probably not the best at advocating what are the scope of our job can be. I suppose I mentioned earlier about like how different my job is to maybe a job working in peds, or, you know, maybe if men don't want to work with kids, you know. But I feel like the role I have is such a, you know, hands-on job. Not that that's something that men want to do all the time. I don't know. It's a strange one. It's not something that's ever hugely bothered me. I'm one of the girls here in the department as well. I've been told, so it's. I think once you're ready to come in and do your job, I don't think gender really comes into the day to days of it.
Yeah, and I guess you're right. It's maybe back to that advocacy role, because I think typically when somebody hears, "Oh, you're a speech and language therapist," you know, "Oh, you're working on R's and S's," and whereas the scope is it's enormous, like even within peds and within adults, you know, the scope is huge.
For sure, and again, it probably it does come back to like what you're exposed to, like in school and things like that. I suppose the reason I ended up in SLT, my. I know we always get mistaken for speech and drama, but my aunt was a speech and drama teacher, and I was always told, "Oh, you'd be a great speech and language therapist." And I said, "Oh, yeah, I suppose I might." And, you know, that's probably how I ended up in this area, not doing any speech and drama at all now. But it's probably a product of your upbringing and exposure and what like people's own experiences are. You know, if your career guidance teacher in school has never heard of or interacted with a speech and language therapist, are they going to suggest it as the job for you? You know, so I think if, again, I mentioned about like shadowing and getting exposure to things, you know, if you're in school, like approach a speech and language therapist. I know we've definitely taken like TY students here on shadow days here at times. There's a TY program here in Beaumont where which I've been involved in at times, where they bring in like groups of TY students, and they go to, I think they spend some days in DCU, and they come into the hospital here, and we have workstations where we show them our Big Macs and iPads and different devices that we use for rehab, and Joe get really positive experiences from it, and people saying, God, I didn't know that that's what a speech and language therapist does at all. So I think, yeah, getting exposure to things is the main way to kind of get maybe more men involved.
Yeah, 100%, absolutely. So we're trying to ask all our guests a question about kind of the benefits of being a member of the IASLT, what you feel like you get out of being a member of the IASLT.
Yeah. I suppose CPD is, I suppose, the biggest one. Having different webinars and different speakers available to do CPD. We're very good here in Beaumont. We have a lot of in-house CPD and in-service and opportunities. But, you know, when there's those extra things that you want a little bit more knowledge on, it's a great way of accessing that. And I suppose, being able to keep track of the CPD, I know that's something that's tricky at times, but you know that the being able to log your CPD on the website is really useful, I find. The MRA service, I suppose, as well, for anybody looking to travel. It's not something that I've looked into just yet, but you know, having that available at some point is great. And when, you know, I know it's really tricky process without that to work as an SLT abroad, so that's a really great service that the ISLT provides.
Yeah, 100%. I think the recording of the CPD is a really important one, and it's something that is really helpful then when Coru come and try and audit you, which actually I got audited last year, so it was really helpful that I just had it and I could record it and send it off.
Yeah, now that I'm speaking about it, I need to do a little update myself of things that have happened the last few weeks. But it's great. put a bookmark on that for me.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a great service. Great. So that brings us to the end of today's conversation. Thank you so much for joining us. And an especially big thank you to Horik for sharing such valuable insights into the world of SLT in adult neurosurgery. If you enjoyed today's episode, don't forget to tune in to the IASLT in Conversation by following our social media channels on Twitter, Instagram, or Facebook, or by searching IASLT Conversation in Spotify, where we continue to explore the stories, science, and voices shaping speech and language therapy in Ireland and beyond. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll see you next time.